Mr., is, how do you pronounce it?
Benjay.
Benjay, okay. Come ahead.
Good afternoon. Please the court. Bryce Benjet, Andrew McCray, CJA counsel. We have pro bono counsel Mark Chahi, Nicole DeSalvo, Jason Liberi, and Andrew Marissas from Skadden Arps as well. This is an application for certificate of appealability from the summary judgment granted denying Rodney Reed's petition for habeas corpus challenging his capital murder conviction and death sentence. For over a decade, we've been asking for meaningful review of forensic proof that establishes Mr. Reed's innocence and that directly contradicts the state's primary evidence at trial, evidence that should have been presented to the jury at his trial in 1998. We believe COA is merited on all issues. However, we're going to focus today primarily on the district court's error in light of Trevino in failing to consider the merits of Reed's ineffective assistance of counsel claim. We ask the court to grant COA on that issue and remand the entire case for further proceeding in light of Martinez versus Ryan and Trevino versus Thaler. And this is exactly what this court did in Cantu versus Thaler, a procedurally identical case. I welcome.
In order to get relief under Martinez and Trevino, you're going to have to be able to show that your ineffective assistance claims were substantial.
Yeah, and the.
So that's really, I mean, there's not any argument about what happened in Trevino. So you need to focus on, well, two things, I guess, really. And that is whether they're substantial as presented, and then following them back through the chain here, including the state court.
That's exactly what I want to do, Your Honor. And I think you're aware of the COA standard, which is a substantial showing, which is not a substitute for the merits consideration, but simply whether this issue is debatable of jurist reason. And even if every jurist wouldn't ultimately resolve that debate against Mr. Reed. So going to the substantial showing of merit as to the trial IAC claim, which necessarily involves a discussion of the facts of the case. Stacy Seitz was a 19-year-old young woman who was engaged to be married to Jimmy Fennell, a local police officer in a rural town outside of Austin, Texas. She was found murdered by the side of the road. Even though another man's sperm was found inside of her body, Jimmy Fennell was the primary suspect in the case throughout the investigation. Mr. Fennell is now currently serving a 10-year sentence after he kidnapped and raped a woman while on patrol as a Georgetown police officer.
Well, I don't know if we need to add that into the – is that relevant here?
I think one of the issues is
– kept out below, right?
Pardon?
It was kept out below. The jury didn't hear that.
The jury couldn't have heard it. And certainly I think that it's something that just informs the whole case. And certainly I do not believe that it's something that impacts what the jury could hear in 1998. I think it would be up to the trial judge whether that would come in if Mr. Fennell were to testify today. But dozens of other suspects.
But you're just on that, on contextual evidence, isn't it simultaneously your position that use of the punishment phase evidence was inappropriate by the state? So if you're saying holistically that we'd be considering anything, including Fennell's predicament today, how can you be simultaneously saying we wouldn't consider any evidence from the punishment phase?
You know, that, I think that is an open question with regard to the application of the standard in House. I would maintain that when you're looking at a hypothetical jury trial, what could come in if Mr. Fennell testified, his felony convictions may very well come in. I do not think that unadjudicated offenses in the punishment phase would be relevant. But again, none of this is.
For that?
You know, frankly, I've looked for authority one way or the other, and there just isn't. But none of this, I think, is material to the question under Trevino in the trial IAC claims. And so aside from – and so dozens of suspects were – DNA was taken from them. they were compared to this to the sperm found in Ms. Stites' body. Ultimately, Mr. Reed was identified as a suspect only because he was involved in an unrelated offense for which he was never convicted. And then there was a match. Based on that match, the state formed its case around Mr. Reed. But there was no evidence linking Mr. Reed to the truck the state alleged that she was kidnapped from. There was no evidence linking Mr. Reed to the scene where her body was found. And frankly, there's no proof supporting the state's theory that she was kidnapped in some location near where Mr. Reed lived.
Those are a lot of statements factually. I thought the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals pointed out that his height and size matched the reclining seat and that, in fact, his place of residence was near where Fennell's truck was found.
I think that what they said, I mean, if you look at what the trial testimony is, most of Bastrop is near where the truck was found.
When you say there's no evidence, the Court of Criminal Appeals actually, after a subsequent hearing, devoted a great deal of analysis to these points. So a crucial legal question is whether we give deference to those findings of fact. So if you say there's no evidence connecting Reed to her, their findings of fact are in contradiction to that.
I think if the court looks at the direct appeal opinion sustaining the sufficiency of the evidence in this case, it is all about a temporal link between the state's theory of a sexual assault. So we have the semen, sexual assault, and murder. That is the heart of the case. And I think if you look at the direct appeal opinion of the CCA, you'll see that that's true. And if you look at the initial findings in the state habeas, there are four pages devoted to establishing that temporal link between the alleged sexual assault, the semen, and the murder. And I don't think that questions about the mirror or where the truck was found is going to be enough to sustain it without that temporal link between this evidence. And so this temporal link theory that was presented to the trial was presented through Dr. Bayardo, who was Travis County Medical Examiner, Karen Blakely, crime scene analyst, Megan Clement, retained DNA analyst. And the thrust of the whole case, and if you look at even the notes sent back by the jury in their deliberations, was about whether this sperm is connected to a sexual assault, is connected to a murder. And so this is the evidence at trial. Trial counsel, when you look at the record, was completely unprepared to contradict this evidence. There was inadequate...
DNA analysts testified on behalf of Reed.
Yes, they did. They had Libby Johnson, who is a DNA analyst.
Why isn't that sufficient?
If she was, first of all, she was not did not even begin working until 2 weeks before evidence began in the case. I believe the jury was already picked before she even started working on the case. Second of all, she admitted that she was not a serologist, that she does not routinely go to crime scenes, and that her expertise was essentially that of a DNA analyst. When you look at that, she was completely unprepared to contradict the state's multidisciplinary team of experts. We had a forensic pathologist, Dr. Bayardo. We had two crime scene analysts, Will Young, Karen Blakely. We had a fingerprint hair and fiber guy, multiple police officers. And so you had a trial team who were not prepared to contradict that.
When you say contradict, though, no one's denying, well, it might be, it might have once been denied there was a sexual assault, but that's not the point. Nor is anyone challenging Reed's DNA match. The issue is just that coincidence of time, correct? That's the issue that you're saying she didn't rebut.
I think she didn't rebut a number of things, and all of it comes to the central aspect of the state's proof, which is the temporal link between sexual conduct between Rodney Reed and Stacy Stites and the murder.
So am I oversimplifying it? If you look at her trial testimony, which, I correct me if I'm wrong, said that sperm could be, it could
remain intact for more than 24 hours?
And she was talking about whose testimony?
Hers, Ms. Johnson's.
Go ahead.
Well, no, you tell me. You'll know the record better.
Ms. Johnson was asked, and I believe it was in the context of a rectal swab, whether she testified, I believe, that there were instances where it could last longer. She did not specify between intact or sperm heads. And prior to that, she admitted that she wasn't a serologist.
Is it Bayardo?
Yes, Dr. Bayardo.
His is the affidavit that's the most starkly reversing, correct? Whether it's many years later. But then even there, his terms are it could have or it suggests. It's highly conditional, which seems to somewhat match exactly what Ms. Johnson said at trial.
I think when you actually sit down and read the context of this evidence in the record, first of all, Dr. Johnson's testimony, if it could be credited at all, I think that courts around the country pay very close attention to when experts have the credentials to say what they're saying. And it was brought out very clearly that she's not a serologist. She certainly wasn't a medical doctor. And what she told the jury did not address this issue of intact sperm. And frankly, it wasn't very credible because she was saying that rectal swabs don't decompose faster than vaginal swabs. That's just not supported by the literature.
Isn't this scientific evidence sort of beyond the point because Mr. Reed could not establish his defense that he had a consensual sexual relationship with the victim? I mean, if he had established that, then this would carry a lot more weight, but he never got over that hurdle.
I think that that was one of the things, parts of the district court's opinion that was truly clearly erroneous. If you look at the magistrate's report, he has this idea that, I'm not really going to credit any of this forensic proof because ultimately we have Mr. Stites' semen in the body. And he doesn't have an explanation to the contrary. No credible witnesses establishing the relationship. If you look back, one of the aspects of the denial of the initial state habeas, in terms of they didn't present these witnesses, was it doesn't matter what these witnesses would have said because we have this temporal link between the sexual assault and the murder. And so, without that severing of the temporal link, the witnesses would not have been credited. And now, when we sever the temporal link, the forensics couldn't
witnesses?
Have been credited. Pardon?
Are you talking about the fact witnesses?
Yeah, I'm talking about the
witness. With somebody
exactly.
Guy. Oh, she said, he said he was going to kill her with a belt, blah, blah, blah. Most of those witnesses are totally discredited. So that's not something should be relied upon.
Well, and I think when you look at the state habeas findings, part of the reason they're discredited in terms of seeing Rodney and Stacy in a romantic relationship is that it's impossible because there is this temporal link between the sexual assault and the murder.
No, it isn't. No. I mean, part of the reason, the main reason that this stuff was discredited is because they weren't credited. The people who testified to the effect that there was this romantic link were not credited, period.
Mm-hmm.
That's the primary basis for the Texas court's holdings.
And even were you to accept that to be true?
Well, I don't know there's a very high standard for us to say we're not going to credit that.
There's a high, I agree. And those were findings made in the context of whether or not there's probable innocence. What we're talking about is ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And one step removed from that, whether there's a substantial showing, whether it's even debatable. And the issue with regard to the...
But if it's not, you can't be ineffective if it's not provable. If the evidence isn't out, if credible evidence isn't out there to gather and present, then there's nothing ineffective about that. I mean, do you have any other evidence? If you got a COA, what would your evidence be other than what's already been explained and discredited?
What we're dealing with here is a secret affair. By its nature, there's not going to be a lot of witnesses.
Any evidence
to
the secret affair being in existence?
If we had more evidence as to a videotape of the two of them together, that would be in the record, Your Honor.
You have no other evidence.
And yes, the evidence that we have is the primary state's witness, Dr. Bayardo, who testified that this was semen recently deposited.
No, I'm talking about the relationship.
Sure.
Yeah.
The evidence in the record is all that there is with regard to the relationship.
Okay.
And the point that I'm making is that the district court led us to essentially an impossible burden. We have the basis of the state's case was this temporal link. I mean, we look at the direct appeal opinion establishing sufficiency of the evidence of that.
But the basis of your defense was a consensual relationship. So you couldn't prove your defense, right? You still can't prove it.
The jury was presented with some of that evidence. They rejected it. But we cannot have confidence in that rejection because they weren't presented with the forensic testimony that would support it. If we, you know, this is the whole point. If so long as Dr. Bayardo is telling them that there is a direct link between the semen, a sexual assault, and a murder, it doesn't matter what anybody says because the science disproves it. The jury was entitled to hear now Dr. Bayardo's opinion saying that the evidence, he's saying affirmatively suggests, this is not a could or possibly, the evidence affirmatively suggests sexual conduct more than 24 hours. Dr. Riddick says it was likely more than 24 hours. Crime Lab Director Singer explains one of the pieces of evidence that the state relied upon was finding DNA on the victim's breast. And they made a big deal of that because they said, well, if she took a shower before the night before, how could this possibly have been a consensual relationship? And Libby Johnson, the DNA analyst, actually agreed with that statement. She said it was likely before she showered. Now when Dr. Singer, when Ron Singer looks at this, an experienced crime scene technician, one who reviewed a videotape of the collection of the evidence, he says that this was probable contamination. And so that's something the jury didn't hear. Again, the jury could not have credited the prior relationship theory without discrediting the state's forensic proof.
But the probable contamination wasn't established either, because didn't the video show that there was a changing of gloves or whatever?
That's a misstatement in the state's brief. If you look at Ron Singer's affidavit, and frankly, if you look at the crime scene video, you can watch her go directly from examining the vaginal area, taking swabs, to examining the breast. And when we're talking about DNA testing, this is not a lot of material that needs to be deposited. And, you know, we're lay people. Ron Singer is a very experienced crime scene technician.
But they said that your statement was incorrect.
I think the court can watch the video.
That he failed to change gloves or something.
What they point to a statement in Ron Singer's affidavit in which he has a paragraph that talks about failing to change gloves. Later down on that same document, different paragraph, he criticizes the manner in which the crime scene video was made, saying that it's not completely documenting the entire examination. It's not that it didn't document the complete examination of the collection of evidence from Ms. Stites' body. And so I think when the court looks at this crime scene video that's in the record, and in fact I think in the habeas petition there are still shots showing the collection, that you can see that this is established. And so again, the jury was told by the defense expert that there was likely sperm on the breast, or saliva on the breast, frankly. And now, in the habeas evidence, had Mr. Reed had effective counsel, they would have been told that was probable contamination.
His counsel on habeas was Barbish, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Barbish's affidavit. His primary complaint is he would have sought more funding to acquire forensic experts beyond Ms. Johnson.
Yeah, after Martinez was issued, and the district court made it clear that we that we pursued this in a diligent fashion. We approached Mr. Barbish and showed him the evidence that we had developed through the habeas proceeding. And you can read his affidavit. He admits that this was a real problem in what he did, and he really didn't quite comprehend the nature of what he was supposed to be doing, and he should have presented this evidence. And so I think that there is a, based on Barbish's affidavit, based on guidelines as to what counsel's supposed to do in state habeas, there's a substantial showing of ineffectiveness as to the state habeas counsel's performance. And then there's a substantial showing as to the trial counsel's performance, both in the clear failures of what they did and then in the impact of what they could have presented to the jury. Again,
what's your best case for ineffectiveness being the quality of the expert as opposed to the failure to call a forensic expert?
Well, I think there's two issues.
No, I'm just
one,
asking you for your best authority on, for that proposition.
I think that there's a lot of authority out there that says that if an expert testifies beyond their expertise, that that's essentially no evidence. A jury can't credit a plumber testifying as to in a medical malpractice case.
So objecting to the foundation for her to be an expert at all, a Daubert, her, she lacked qualifications as opposed to the statement that she made?
And even if she were qualified, she did not present testimony that was that could have been presented, that could have attacked the state's case. And when you step back and look at what happened at trial, there was a defense theory that was doomed to fail because the state had presented this temporal link that prevented the jury from ever considering the any consensual relationship.
Thank you. You saved some time for rebuttal. Mr. Sullivan.
May it please the court, James P. Sullivan for the director. Under Section 2254E1, this court should take as given three crucial findings of fact. First, Stacy Stites was raped before she was murdered. Second, the semen found in her vagina belonged to Rodney Reed. And third, there was no pre-existing relationship between Stites and Reed. In fact, when Reed was questioned by the police initially, he said he didn't even know Stites and had only seen her on the news. This court must presume that these findings by the state court are correct under Section 2254E1. Taken together, they put the lie to the assertion of actual innocence in this case, and they leave no room for debate as to any of the underlying constitutional claims. Accordingly, this court should not issue a certificate of appealability.
Two questions right away. First, do you think there's no case law out there that would deny that we give deference to those findings of fact?
I am aware of none that would say that you do, and in fact, I think that it's telling that my friend in opposition urges this court to create a circuit split with the Fourth Circuit, and we would urge you not to do that. And I'm aware of none. And in fact, in our brief, we've collected an addition to the Fourth Circuit, in which I believe it was Judge Wilkinson gave a very careful treatment of the issue. I think the Third, Sixth, and many others also in their practice have likewise given that presumption of correctness under 2254E1 to findings of fact in circumstances like these where we have a Schlupp claim. And so we would urge you not to create a circuit split. But even if this were the first court to consider the question whether the presumption of correctness in 2254E1 applies to a Schlupp gateway argument, you should still resolve that question in favor of the director here. And that's pretty apparent when you look at the actual text of the statute. I think that it's sometimes unhelpful to talk about these issues in terms of deference because it takes us away from the actual language of the statute. 2254E1 says that in a proceeding instituted by an application for writ of habeas corpus by a person in custody pursuant to the judgment of a state court, so that is a federal habeas case with a state prisoner, just like this one, a determination of a factual issue made by a state court shall be presumed to be correct. The applicant shall have the burden of rebutting the presumption of correctness by clear and convincing evidence. There's no conditional language there
that
makes this flavor of case different than any other. And that's in part because this presumption of correctness actually predates AEDPA by about three decades. The original presumption of correctness codified in Chapter 153 of Title 28 of the United States Code was originally codified at Section 2254D. It was a longer provision than this because it had eight codified exceptions to the presumption of correctness. But the Supreme Court put this, or rather, I'm sorry, the Congress did this in response to
I mean, that's helpful, and that's fully responsive.
Thank you.
To my question. This may seem somewhat esoteric, but the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the only divergent opinions, the two concurrences, were arguing as to whether they should even have done the factual inquiry they did. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. There was no division of opinion as to the result of this case. It was only a state law sausage-making set of opinions that were these separate opinions, namely, do we defer to the trial judge in every circumstance, or is the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals a court that can step in and undo this? And the court decided we are the ultimate finder of fact, but in many cases we will ride the coattails of the trial judge who actually observed the witness demeanor.
But they didn't. Now, last question on your first opening, and then I'll let you go back to your opening paragraph. But you mentioned the fact that Reed didn't acknowledge when he was first spoken to. But when he was approached by the Texas Rangers, if they're the people that first approached him,
mm-hmm.
they didn't disclose to him that they had any DNA. So there would be no reason he would volunteer that he had been in a relationship with a woman who's just been murdered.
That's why many criminal defense lawyers urge their clients not to speak to the police. But Mr. Reed was apprised of his rights and knowingly waived them. After having been read his rights, this is what he wrote down in the presence of a witness and of that officer. Quote, I don't know Stacy Stites, never seen her other than what was on the news. The only thing that I do know is what was said on the news is that she was murdered. So if this was a secret affair, it was even a secret to Mr. Reed at the time that he was being questioned here. So if we could return just briefly, unless I'm pre-permitting a question here, just on the issue of Section 2254E1, we think that it's both important that this court accord that presumption of correctness to the three crucial findings of fact that I've listed above, and I'd be happy to provide you with citations for any of them if you have any questions about those findings. But we think that it's really important that you apply them here because even the certificate of appealability determination is viewed through the lens of the procedural and substantive barriers erected in Section 2254.
They aren't disputing those three facts necessarily. They're saying, yes, rape, yes, semen matched, and perhaps disputing, well, I guess they are disputing the relationship.
They must dispute.
They are disputing that, but they're disputing it purely through the lens of the forensic evidence.
Yes, forensic evidence, most of which was presented to the state court. And this brings me to the second piece of subparagraph E of 2254.
Was Bayardo's reversal presented to the state court?
No, and I think that that's really, first of all, I think that that's really important, Judge Higginson, and second of all, we can then talk about what Judge Bayardo said. The reason that it's really important under it's Dr. Bayardo and it's Dr. Johnson, not Ms. Johnson. Dr. Bayardo. So 2254E2 severely limits the power of a federal habeas court for a state prisoner to entertain evidence and hold hearings. And the trigger, the opening paragraph to 2254E2 imposes a diligence requirement. It only applies if the applicant has failed to develop the factual basis. Well, we're here talking about a Trevino argument, which in turn is carrying on its back, and in effect, a Strickland argument. Now, the very nature of that argument is that the lawyers representing Reed in the state habeas proceedings failed to develop the evidence that they now want you to consider, but that they did not present to the state court, which should have been the main event here. And under Michael Williams, the Supreme Court's opinion in Michael Williams from 2000, the court made quite clear that the mistakes, negligence, et cetera, of a state habeas lawyer are attributed to the client and can show the lack of diligence that triggers 2254E2. Once again, it's telling. My friends in opposition here are very able, and I think that they understand where the weak points in the case are, and that's why they have to tell you that you shouldn't apply the presumption of correctness that by its plain terms applies, And it's why they tell you that 2254E2 doesn't apply, because in their words, as they say on pages 10, 12, and 16 of the reply brief, Trevino somehow created a common law exception to the statutory restrictions imposed by 2254E2. That doesn't make really any sense of the Supreme Court's opinions in Martinez and Trevino. Martinez and Trevino altered the judicially created procedural default doctrine, which you'll find nowhere. It's kind of lurks in the interstices of the federal habeas statute. But unlike the exhaustion requirement or the relitigation bar or the presumption of correctness, the procedural default doctrine recognized by the Supreme Court in Wainwright versus Sykes and in other cases like that is nowhere found in the statute. And that's why the Supreme Court in Martinez and Trevino, and I litigated the Trevino case with my able colleagues in the Solicitor General's office, that's why the Supreme Court was able to change it without regard to any statutory text, because there was none. But Trevino and Martinez don't tell you anything about how your hands or the hands of the federal district judges over whom you sit, what they can do to gather this evidence. And so because of the restrictions of 2254E2, you actually shouldn't consider Dr. Bayardo's 16 year later about face, nor, and I think that it's really important with this very large record to distinguish between two different things that Dr. Riddick said. There's the Riddick affidavit from 2006, which was presented in the state court, but then there's also a Riddick declaration from 2010 that was only presented to the federal court, in which he too makes sudden and miraculous changes in what he thinks he sees from the forensics that he isn't very well familiar with in terms of the record of this case. So you shouldn't consider either of those things under 2254E2. But even if you did, we would urge the court to essentially discount them for the same reasons that Judge Yackel did in his order denying the motion to alter or amend under Rule 59E. So after the report and recommendation came down, and after the Judge Yackel had adopted it in large part and rejected a few parts of it, my friends in opposition filed a Rule 59E motion and said, you forgot to take into account Bayardo and Dr. Riddick insofar as they told you that the most likely thing that happened was that the semen found in Stacey Stites' vagina was actually put there more than 24 hours before she was killed. And I think that Judge Yackel gets this just right, and there's not a lot that I can do to improve upon it, but he described these statements by Riddick and Bayardo as, quote, too speculative to constitute reliable evidence because, quote, they provide no explanation regarding how much sperm one would expect to find from a recent ejaculation as opposed to one that was days old, nor do the affidavits address the non-forensic evidence pointing to recent sexual assault or plausible reasons for discovering a limited amount of sperm. And so, again, this is a really important part of their case because at the beginning of my presentation, which is unfortunately nasal because of the weather in Austin, and I apologize, I think, Judge Higginson, that they actually are challenging some of these findings of fact, and especially the third one. When they talk about the temporal link here, what they're really talking about is this third finding of fact about no pre-existing relationship. They're trying to now dance away from some of the skepticism that I think Judge Clement rightly pointed at the nine witnesses or whatever the parade has grown to of highly incredible witnesses with criminal pasts and close relations to Mr. Reed and stories that didn't add up and people who were constantly saying, you mentioned me in your affidavit and that's not true, you are a liar. And so now what they want to say instead is, this was a secret affair. Maybe my friends didn't know about it, or maybe they did, but the forensic evidence shows you that, in fact, I didn't ejaculate in Stacey Stites' vagina right before she was killed, but instead did so 24 hours before she was killed or more, and therefore that must have been consent because she would have told her police officer fiancé that she had been raped otherwise. So they are trying to sever the link. They're going directly counter to what the CCA said about this. The CCA said, quote, despite Reed's efforts, he presents no credible evidence showing that he had a romantic relationship with Stacey. And then they later said, and that's at page 749, 271 Southwest 3rd. And then the court later said, quote, it is highly unlikely that any reasonable juror would view the presence of Reed's semen in Stacey's vagina as the byproduct of an intimate consensual interlude between the two. So they're trying to fight that now with forensics that they never presented to the state court in the first place and that you shouldn't consider because of 2254E2. Their basis for doing so really doesn't actually stack up. So if you do decide that you want to consider Riddick's declaration from 2010 and Dr. Bayardo's affidavit, which was presented so late in the game that it even came after the magistrate had presented his report and recommendation, and Judge Yackel deemed that, I think, something like highly suspect or extremely suspect or something like that. But if you look at the things that they had to say to try to support this severing of the temporal link that's now suddenly very important to Reed's case, it really doesn't add up, and in fact, it's contradicted by much of the other evidence that they've presented to you. So essentially what they say is, well, Dr. Bayardo still believes that there was anal rape in this case. He just doesn't think that the rapist ejaculated inside of Stacy Seitz's rectum. And so he hasn't actually really walked back all that much. On the one point, though, that is now suddenly important, and that is the semen in Stacy Seitz was more than 24 hours old, they base that on the fact that they didn't find enough semen or sperm inside of Seitz's corpse, and that's the reason that they thought that it must have been there for a long time. There are a few problems with this.
Bayardo's saying in this later opinion, is he saying that some newly discovered evidence has come to light, or is he saying it's newly presented, and I just didn't anticipate where the prosecutors would take it in closing argument?
For the most part, he says that I didn't anticipate where they were going to take this, and then he says, and I apologize, there we go. I'm sorry. The fact that I found, this is quoting, and this is at A1467 from the helpful appendix that my friends in opposition have prepared. This is the affidavit from Dr. Bayardo. Yes. There was testimony at the trial from Dr. Bayardo, and he's just now years later describing
it.
Yes, that's right. And he says, the fact that I found very few, as stated in the autopsy report, spermatozoa in Ms. Stites's vaginal cavity suggests that the spermatozoa was not deposited less than 24 hours before Ms. Stites's death. So he says, I didn't find very many sperm. Well, there are actually two pieces of good evidence to rebut this, and happily for me, they both come from Reed and his lawyers. The first is that Dr. Johnson, his own expert in this case, testified, and this is found at page 712 of the CCA's opinion, quote, Dr. Johnson admitted that a male can deposit a small amount of sperm without ejaculating when there is penetration. And then in the literature that he presents, and I apologize that I'm blanking, but I believe it was in the Green book, but it may have been another one, but I can give it to you on 28J if you're curious. The medical literature explains that low frequency or low count of sperm, even in an ejaculate, can be the result of things like depleted stores for somebody who ejaculates frequently. And as Judge Yackel explained, I thought quite thoroughly in discussing this, the idea that we didn't find very much semen or didn't find very many sperm is also really lacking in any kind of scientific basis. And that's why Judge Yackel called it, quote, too speculative to constitute reliable evidence. He didn't say, this is what you would normally expect to find. This is what we know about the normal pattern of Mr. Reed's ejaculation or anything else like this. He just said, I didn't see very much, and that's how I knew that it must have been in there for a long time. Now, set aside the fact that much of the clinical literature that's been presented to you by my friends in opposition talks about sperm that's discovered with, I think, cervicovaginal scrapings, not things that are falling out in the field, falling into a woman's underwear. But then there's also the fact that in discussing this, there's not a whole lot of discussion of the, for instance, the mapping of the underwear, where they looked and they found some spots of semen found on the underwear. There's no explanation from Dr. Riddick or from Dr. Bayardo about how that would have happened or whether that was something one might expect to see if somebody has had vaginal intercourse a day or two or 10 days prior. And so there's really no evidence there, and I think that's why Judge Yackel really discounted all of this.
As opposed to being raped and drug out of a car.
Right. Or, yeah, there, and of course there are other possibilities. And, you know, The Reed now argues about how when the forensic people from the state moved the corpse, this could have jostled things and moved some of this evidence around. But we also need to account for the fact that the woman who was raped and then murdered was not poisoned with rat poison or shot once in the head. I mean, it was a quite violent death that likely included a great deal of struggle. And that's one of the things that Dr. Riddick really doesn't ever account for. Dr. Riddick says that there wasn't any evidence of rape if he's correct that there was no anal trauma discovered on the autopsy. But that's simply false. Stites was found, her zipper was broken, so it had been forcibly, her pants had been forcibly opened so powerfully that actually some of the teeth had been torn off. Her underwear was found bunched around her hips. She had fresh bruises that were from before the time that she died, and you know that because if the heart is no longer beating, then you don't bruise. She had fresh bruises and a mark something like a fingernail digging into the skin, the kind of marks that you would imagine if somebody is being held down. And she had been punched in the skull so hard that, in fact, on the autopsy, the punch was evident from the inside of the skull after the brain had been removed. And so the idea that there wasn't any evidence other than anything having to do with the examination of Stites' anus is simply incorrect, and the CCA so found. And that's why they concluded at pages 748 and 749 that, quote, compelling independent circumstantial evidence showed that Reed forced Stacy to have vaginal intercourse. So once again, the idea that they're not fighting any of these findings of fact that you should presume correct is simply belied by the record as it comes here from the state courts. Now, because, oh, I'm sorry.
He's beginning with Trevino and the Ibarra error below.
Yes.
So what if you turn to that? Why wouldn't we be granting just on that basis alone? And if we were to, is there an option not to remand?
Well, this was the, so when I didn't prepare the brief in this case, but when I took over to present this oral argument to you, that was the first thing that I was prepared to, if I thought the record supported it, was to come up here and tell you that we confess error insofar as you should remand or something like that. Because as Justice Ginsburg is fond of saying, and as I think is probably true of this court in all but the most unusual cases, this is a court of review and not a course of first view. And the district court has yet to pass on either the Trevino issue or on the underlying ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims because they were procedurally defaulted. And so that was kind of where I thought that this might go. But because we're talking – two things. Because we're talking about whether you should issue a certificate of appealability here, I think it's first necessary to turn briefly to the text of Section 2253C, which outlines the requirements for a certificate of appealability. Paragraph 2 – say paragraphs 2 and 3 say that any such certificate that you might issue has to, quote, indicate – that Reed has carried his burden and, quote, made a substantial showing of the denial of a constitutional right. So if you come away from the impressive briefing effort from my friends in opposition and everything that we tell you today, and you think it's debatable whether this person has an actual innocence gateway under Schlupp, and that's the only thing that you find debatable, you cannot issue a certificate of appealability because you will not have indicated any debatable constitutional claim. And, of course, actual innocence claims themselves are squarely foreclosed, as discussed in this Court's opinion in Swearingen. So if you were only talking about debatability about the procedural issue of whether an actual innocence gateway would excuse a procedural default, you would not yet have a valid certificate of appealability. And similarly, now that we're speaking about Trevino, and I apologize for meandering away from your question for a moment, Judge Higginson, but the Trevino issue, if the only thing that you find debatable is whether the state habeas lawyer performed ineffectively and prejudiced his client thereby, then that, too, would not by itself be enough on debatability to support a certificate of appealability because, as the Supreme Court explained in Martinez and again in Trevino, they were not recognizing any constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel on state habeas proceedings. They were instead recognizing a narrow, as they called it, exception to Coleman versus Thompson and changing their judicially created procedural default doctrine. But you would still have to find debatable the underlying ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim itself. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can go through them either way you want to. I'll start with the Strickland claim, but tell me if you'd like me to go the other way. The Strickland claim fails if
well, for... Just
You're going quickly. It's
I'm
helpful,
sorry.
But when you say go the other way, what do you mean by that?
Well, do you want to talk about Strickland first, or do you want to talk about Trevino first? Do you want to talk about ineffective assistance of trial counsel, IAC trial, or IAC habeas?
My choice would be start with Trevino.
Okay. Well, then we'll do it that way. So the reason that Barbish, the state habeas lawyer here, was not ineffective is that all of the arguments that he is now accused, all of the Strickland arguments he's now accused of having unprofessionally failed to present, none of them would have worked, and in fact, there was good reason for him not to present them. So it's not true, first of all, to say that Barbish failed to present Strickland arguments, because he actually presented four in the first state habeas application, including, and I think this is really important, the most important Strickland argument that could be presented in this case, and the only one that could have actually won this case for Reed. A case with all of these facts that I've described to you before. Barbish, in the first state habeas application, said trial counsel was ineffective because they did not come forward with the evidence necessary to prove some kind of secret affair or pre-existing relationship between Stites and Reed. And in fact, state habeas counsel, although he may have now self-immolated in some affidavit and is now, I guess, willing to have his reputation dragged through the mud, he actually did a fine job. If I remember correctly, he went and found the nine witnesses.
Well, it isn't that he's self-immolating or dragging himself in the mud. He just says, I didn't get enough money to do it. Right?
Yeah, maybe so.
I should have asked for more money.
You should be his PR guy. I think that may be the best way for him to say it without him looking like, I just didn't know what I was doing at all. But even with whatever limitations on funds he might complain about now, he still went out and made the Strickland claim that matters here, and that is, I need to find some way to account for my client's semen being found inside of a corpse. And the way to do that is to explain some innocent explanation for that very inconvenient forensic fact, which still is not debated in this case and still is not contested by my friends in opposition. He tried to do it. It didn't work. It was rejected by the CCA. And as to that merits adjudication, if it were being pressed here, that is something that would be foreclosed by the relitigation bar of 2254D. But he actually went and did the work. So to say that he was ineffective, it really doesn't wash here. He took the only shot that could have won this case, and it didn't work. And if that didn't work, then there's also no prejudice, because without accounting for the presence of the semen, all of the things that they're trying to get you to do now, for the same reasons and skepticism that's been expressed from the bench today and that was explained by the CCA and explained by Magistrate Judge Austin and explained by District Judge Yackel, none of those things work unless you can get rid of that core inconvenient truth for them that the semen found was his and he doesn't have an explanation for it. So we don't think that it's even debatable that there is IAC habeas, which, again, is not a freestanding constitutional claim. And also, under Trevino, in addition, as I believe Judge King suggested, they would have to also establish that the underlying Strickland claim is substantial. Right. And for all of the reasons that we've discussed, I don't think that they've done that. Because even if they say, for example, we should have gotten the Riddick affidavit, the first trial counsel should have done that, and then the first state habeas lawyer should have complained about the first trial lawyer not doing that, none of that stuff does anything unless it can account for the presence of the semen. Now, I also want to just correct the mistaken notion, I think, that my friend in opposition suggested, which is that the only evidence linking him to this crime is this kind of CSI Miami stuff, because that's not all there is. If you look at page 749 of the CCA's opinion again, they described all of the other evidence that does tie Reed to this crime. For example, the fact that he routinely walked this area of town late at night, along the route that Stites drove to work at the grocery store, that the truck was found close to his house, that the seat in the truck was reclined so that a woman 5'7", as Ms. Stites was, wouldn't be able to see out the rearview mirror, but a man 6'2", as Reed is, would be able to see out the mirror, and on and on, and it's the very last paragraph on page 749. And I think that it really shuts down the idea that this is just a case about semen. It only needs to be a case about that because that wins the case for us and should preclude you from granting a certificate of appealability. But it's incorrect to say that the only basis here was forensic. There was a lot of other stuff here. So let's see, the next thing. My friend in opposition has suggested that because Jimmy Fennell or Jimmy Fennell is a bad guy, a rapist, a misogynist, and a racist, all of which I'm perfectly happy to stipulate, too. He seems like a reprehensible human. But none of these things establish that it was Fennell or Fennell who murdered Stacey Stites any more than Reed's reputation as a serial rapist. And a question was asked when my friend was at the podium as to whether the evidence of the five or six, something like that, sexual assaults, for which many of which still have pending indictments in them, whether that should be considered when you're doing the Schlupp gateway. And you absolutely should, Your Honor. And I think my best evidence for that would be Schlupp and House themselves, because they say, don't limit yourself to admissibility. Look at the whole record. And there's a reason to look at the whole record, and that is we're actually making an equitable determination whether it would be a miscarriage of justice so grave that we just can't live with ourselves to stand on the judicially created procedural default doctrine and not hear this person's underlying constitutional claim. And so you should consider everything. You should consider the fact that that 6 months before Reed raped and murdered Stites, he raped another woman after punching her in the head near the same place around the same time of night. And you should consider the fact that 6 months after, he attempted to do the same thing around the same time and around the same place. You should consider all of those things if you're trying to decide whether, as the standard is put in House, it is, quote, more likely than not that any reasonable juror would have reasonable doubt. With everything that we've discussed here today, I would think that it would actually go just the opposite. Not only would every reasonable juror have reasonable doubt, it's hard to imagine any reasonable juror having reasonable doubt with all of these facts as you should presume them to be correct and with all of the evidence tying Reed to this crime.
The third individual that was a focus at trial as a possible suspect was Lawson?
Lawhon, I think.
Lawhon?
Yeah, L-A-W-H-O-N.
Yeah. But he was ruled out as a suspect based on the DNA match. Is that fair to say?
Not only based on the DNA match, Your Honor.
The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals implies that's what it was.
It's not the only. I don't think it's the only thing that they talked about. They also talked about. So Lawhon was earlier committed and was later convicted of a similar rape murder of a woman named Arlt, although in a different part of town. And he made some statements suggesting when he was trying to, I think, scare witnesses, he said, I will kill you. And he said, I did that girl up in Bastrop. So you are, I guess, to infer that he was talking about Stites. But his own wife testified that on the night that he raped and murdered Arlt, she noticed that he was gone and confronted him about it when he got home. And he had an alibi for the Stites night. I believe he was helping care for a small child or something like that. So it's not just the fact that the DNA wasn't Lawhon's. But again, even if DNA were the only thing, there is no contest in this case as to whether the DNA belongs to Lawhon or Reed. They're still not fighting that. I apologize that my time has expired and that I've taken so much of yours.
Thank you.
I'd like to address two aspects of my opposing counsel's presentation. One, with regard to procedural issues on a Trevino claim, and second, with regard to the facts establishing prejudice. First, I think that there's two issues that he presented with regard to Trevino. And to even take one step back, I think we have to look at the case of Cantu versus Thaler, which is the case Judge Clement was on the panel, in which there was not a discussion of the merits of the issue. It was that this was a change in the decisional law. It was preserved, and it is appropriate for the district court to consider how that decisional law gets applied in the first instance. Just as opposing counsel has said, this is a court of review. And that's actually supported by this court's decision in Whitehead versus Johnson, in which there was a finding of cause, and the COA was essentially granted on the finding of cause, and then this court said, we don't have even jurisdiction to consider the merits of the IAC claim because that was not something that was decided below. And so we have to send this back. And so again, I think there is a substantial showing of merit as to these claims, but I don't think that that is necessarily controls the court's decision. With regard to 2254E2. Trevino versus Thaler and Martinez versus Ryan, it's very clear that this is an establishing cause. They declined to find a constitutional right to counsel, but on state habeas, but they said ineffective assistance at the state habeas level establishes cause. We have this court's decision in Barrientos. Even in House versus Bell, the Supreme Court says that cause is an exception, means you did not fail to develop. We've established cause. And therefore, 2254E2's provisions, which are about failure to develop, simply don't apply. Now, with regard to 2254E1, our position is certainly that in this context it should not apply, certainly in the holistic equitable determination described by opposing counsel. But even if it does, and this court decides to follow the Fifth Circuit, the Fifth Circuit has another opinion called Telugas versus Pearson, which is 689, Fed Third 322, in which the court said, well, we're going to apply 2254E1, this presumption,
Fourth Circuit.
And the Fourth Circuit says, we're going to apply that under Sharp. But it's just a presumption, and the district court needs to allow the petitioner to present evidence to rebut that presumption, and that could take the form of an evidentiary hearing. And likewise, in Barrientos, it says, if you establish cause, it goes back to the district court to consider the evidence and grants an evidentiary hearing if required. And again, I mean, if you look at what the evidence that we presented, none of it has ever been rebutted by the state. Never. They've had over 10 years to contradict the evidence that we presented. They never had. And with regard to Dr. Bayardo and the district court's faulting us for, you know, essentially we were accused of sandbagging his testimony for 16 years, there's strong case law that says that you don't fail to develop evidence of a recanting witness. You don't expect a witness to recant, especially one who's testified for the state. Fourth Circuit case law, particularly on point, is Wolf versus Johnson, which is 565 Fed Third 140 at note 42. And so when you have a witness who essentially recants, we didn't expect him to do that, and no reasonable person would have.
Is he employed by the state or is he privately employed?
Dr. Bayardo was the Travis County medical examiner employed by Travis County. Yes.
About when he retired.
And he was private and we unretained, just testified as essentially out of his duty as continuing to work on the case. So he was not retained by the petitioner. He just provided the information. And so, again, we didn't fail. I don't believe that we failed to develop Dr. Bayardo, and I think that the district court's finding that we were somehow not diligent in presenting this, what I think is fair to call a recantation, was clearly erroneous.
But he didn't stop at the untimeliness. Judge Yackel didn't agree that this was a recantation. He says when you actually look at it, it's more faulting again what the prosecutors drew out of what he testified.
Well, I think that you have, first you have the order on the report in which he says that he just faults the state. And then when we pointed out on the Rule 59 that, in fact, he says affirmatively the evidence suggests more than 24 hours, he says, oh, well, it's too speculative anyway. And I invite the court to take a look at the testimony of the forensic experts at trial. And they are no less speculative. They don't explain why they're reaching their conclusions. They just tell the jury the conclusion. And trial counsel did not contradict that. That's the problem here. We have scientific evidence pointing the finger at Mr. Reed that when uncontradicted, that's ineffective, that's deficient performance. We have evidence now that shows that it could have been. That is prejudice. And so, again, we look at 2254E2. A failure to develop doesn't apply to cause. 2254E1, presumption of correctness can be rebutted with new evidence, including an evidentiary hearing. Neither one of those precludes consideration of this evidence. Now,
looking at Yackel's decision, the only point where the presumption was conclusive with no, correct me if I'm wrong, though, sure, was as to the Barnett was she the one who stated that she'd seen fennel with Stites?
Yes, Martha Barnett, yes.
And there, his treatment of that evidence was that purely the presumption of correctness, correct?
I think that those claims were the Brady claims in which there was an adjudication on the merits, and therefore 2254D applies, where that's different. There's a presumption of correctness, but then there's also 2254D, which essentially says you can't contradict it. And so that's not at issue at all here.
Right, okay.
And I think that the state has not even asserted the pinholster argument that they made in their briefs. But the issue is 2254E1, and it's a rebuttable presumption, one in which new evidence can be considered. And so lastly, I want to turn to the arguments about that if we don't have these eyewitnesses to the relationship, we can never prove our case, and therefore there's no prejudice, and that state habeas counsel went with the only game that they had. If you look at A186 of the addendum, which is the findings adopted by the state court, it says that based on Bayardo's testimony, Reed did it. I mean, conclusively says that because of this link, there was no opportunity for this to be anything but a rape and a murder. And so that's the findings of the CCA. We believe those are contradicted by our evidence. But again, I think under Cantu versus Thaler, the only option for this court right now is to remand it to the district court so they can consider the Supreme Court's decision in the first instance.
You're court appointed?
Actually, yes, I'm court appointed, although because of my now I'm a staff attorney with the Innocence Project in New York, I'm only asking for my expenses since I've started.
Well, I wasn't challenging your bill. I was just going to thank you for all that you've done here because it's really substantial, and we appreciate that.
Oh, thank you, Judge.
You're welcome. The court will be in recess.